Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Russian foreign minister calls for a dialogue in Ukraine. Ukrainians say the Kiev government is not in control. A closer look at the terrorist business of hostage-taking.
The nature of their demands is often pertains to the building up of their organization.
Thailand sets new elections for July 20th, but the opposition is still on the fence. And British actor Bob Hoskin dies. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has called for talks between Kiev and pro-Russian separatists in southeastern Ukraine. He said, quote, Russia believes that this dialogue between the authorities in Kiev and their opponents could be established or launched in the framework of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. We hope that our partners, our Western colleagues, allow Ukrainians to establish this dialogue without major impediment, end quote. The prime minister spoke during a visit to Peru. In eastern Ukraine, local authorities said Wednesday pro-Russian gunmen seized control of a city council building in Horlivka, a city of 290,000 residents north of the industrial hub of Donetsk. Separatists now control about a dozen cities in Ukraine's industrial east, including Donetsk, where rebels have set a referendum on secession for May 11th. A similar vote last month led to Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. An estimated 40,000 Russian troops are deployed on the Ukrainian border, poised to invade if the order comes from Moscow. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnera looks at the makeup of the Russian military.
Western estimates say the Russian Defense Ministry controls between 800,000 and 1 million men under arms. These include strategic rocket forces, as well as the various services, air, air defense, ground, and naval. And there are various kinds of special forces, such as the Spetsnaz, belonging to Russia's military intelligence, or GRU. Stephen Blank, an expert on the Russian military at the American Foreign Policy Council, says there are also paramilitary forces.
The other forces belong to other ministries. The Ministry of Interior, which are the internal forces of the MVD. The FSB has forces, that's the intelligence. There are border troops. And then there are paramilitaries like various Cossack formations. So there are lots of people involved here, probably something like a million men total in the regular armed forces, several hundred thousand more in these auxiliaries of the MVD, SSB, and Cossacks, and so on.
Ian Brzezinski from the Atlantic Council says the Russian government is spending a lot of money to modernize its armed forces.
$750 billion between now and end of the next decade to, you know, replenish their maritime fleet, to replenish their air forces, to bring in fifth-generation aircraft, even more sophisticated air and missile defense systems. They continue to robustly test and develop new ballistic missile capabilities, and they continue their modernization of their ground forces.
Brzezinski and others say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions.
You may recall the pictures of drunk soldiers straggling in the rear, trying to catch up to the frontline troops, and the fact that the Russians had a little bit of difficulty taking on the Georgians, which didn't put on that strong a defense, and they were able to kind of press forward simply pure mass rather than skill.
Experts say one reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts, rather than with the massive Soviet-style army. Kerr Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says during the Georgian War, coordination between the different armed service branches was a problem for the Russians.
They didn't, for example, have the right kind of embedded forward air controllers with their ground units in order to actually communicate with air power. So some of the air losses in the Georgia War were actually shot down by their own side, by the Russians.
Ian Brzezinski says the results of the reform were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula.
You see the way they've been performing in Crimea, where you had 20,000 to 30,000 Russian troops fan across that peninsula. Pretty slick uniforms, well-maintained equipment, and real stunningly or impressive discipline and communication silence. Communications discipline. They're certainly far more capable than they were 6 years ago.
Stephen Blank from the American Foreign Policy Council puts it this way.
What the improvement is the use of these forces in an extraordinarily disciplined, bloodless, swift way
in conjunction with information warfare against Ukraine, saturation of the Crimea and eastern Ukraine with Russian propaganda, and the deployment of highly trained, modernized, combined forces on the Western strategic direction to intimidate, divert, and immobilize NATO and the Ukrainian armed forces.
Blank says members of the Russian military leadership believe that the end of the Cold War was an American special operation to take down the Soviet Union without firing a shot. And it succeeded. Blank says the Russian military tried to do the same with success in Crimea. Andre Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
A recent survey found that Ukrainians have little faith in the interim government that replaced ousted President Viktor Yanukovych, with the majority of respondents telling pollsters it has little control over events buffeting the country. Jamie Detmer reports from Kiev.
It probably isn't what the U.S. government wanted to hear from an opinion poll it funded. Still, a survey conducted for the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, a Washington-based international non-profit organization that assists elections in new and emerging democracies, found that Ukrainians think their country's in the grip of chaos and don't believe the interim government is effective. The poll, which was conducted in mid-April, found that there are widespread doubts about the legitimacy and effectiveness of the government of acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. The poll illustrates the scale of the challenge facing the interim government, not only in Ukraine's troubled east, where hardcore pro-Russian separatists stormed several government buildings in the city of Luhansk on Monday, but across the country. Rakesh Sharma is a research director at IFES, which receives most of its funding from the U.S. State Department and the United Nations.
In Ukraine overall, 23% of respondents say that the government has full control or significant control in the country. But you have 27% saying that it has no control at all, and 45% saying that it's not in much control of the situation in the country.
In the rest of East, 80% of respondents said they consider the interim government illegitimate, a much higher percentage than anywhere else in Ukraine.
In Kharkiv and Donetsk, in those focus groups, what we heard were people saying primarily that this government does not represent us. We do not feel like our interests are being represented by this government, and that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the direction of the country and the way it was headed.
Many pro-unity Ukrainians are also unimpressed by the interim government.
Even in the Kharkiv and Donetsk focus groups, people who had pro-Ukrainian views, people who wanted those regions to stay part of the country, even they would express a lot of concerns about the government.
With the unrest spreading in the east, where pro-Russian separatists have seized more than 30 government buildings in at least a dozen towns, the government admitted Wednesday that its forces are helpless to quell unrest by pro-Russian activists. Kiev and Western governments say the agitation is being encouraged by Moscow. The Kremlin denies it is fueling the unrest. Some analysts and activists now argue that Kiev mishandled the East and never took the region's grievances, many of which are economic, seriously enough. They say the stalled military campaign to combat pro-Russian separatists has only aggravated the problem. That is a view U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt may share. On Tuesday, he disclosed he had advised the Kiev government against the use of force to combat separatists. Pyatt also defended the latest round of targeted sanctions imposed by the United States on Russia, saying they could influence the thinking of Moscow.
I think it's way too early to write off these sanctions as inconsequential. I've seen some commentary saying, oh, it's not enough. But I think if you look at the kind of losses Russian markets have faced over the past weeks, I think it's quite a bit too early to say that these actions are not going to have a significant impact on the calculus of the Russian government.
With discontent rising, the Kiev government will hope the ambassador is right. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
Thailand says new elections will be held July 20th to try to end months of political deadlock. But the main opposition party says it has not decided whether it will participate. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
The main opposition Democrat Party says another election is not feasible under present conditions. Party spokesman Chavanon Intarakamalyasut tells VOA the government needs to agree to implement reforms for the Democrats to participate in polling.
I don't see that we can have the free and fair election. We are afraid that the upcoming election, if it could ever happen on July 20, is going to be the same as what happened February 2nd.
The Democrats boycotted that election, and anti-government protesters blockaded enough polling stations to invalidate the vote. Since then, there has been little progress in bridging the divide between the government and its opponents, leading to worries the prolonged standoff is scaring off tourists and foreign investors and damaging the economy. Chavanon says the Democrats want to see an election held eventually for the sake of the nation, but not before key reforms are in place.
We accept the reality of the Thai society now, that we are facing some problems. We're having conflicts, and that we have to solve this first before we're heading for election.
The spokesman says party leader and former Prime Minister Apisit Wechachiwa will announce Saturday his reform proposal that would have to be accepted by all parts of society. That, he says, must include the interim government and the anti-government protest movement as a condition for the Democrats to participate in any election. The kingdom has been enmeshed in political turmoil for 8 years. Anti-government demonstrators want to remove the influence of the Shinawat family from Thai politics. Caretaker Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat's elder brother, Thaksin, a wealthy businessman, was prime minister for 5 years until 2006, when he was ousted in a coup amid street protests by the Yellow Shirt movement. Thaksin is in self-imposed exile to avoid being imprisoned for a corruption conviction. Despite living abroad, he still holds significant influence over his sister's government and the Piao Thai Party. Ms. Yingluck came to power following the 2011 general election, but her government has been only partly functional since December, when she dissolved parliament and called for the February election. Pro-government activists known as the Red Shirts fear protesters could try to again disrupt the next election, resulting in another nullification. Ms. Yingluck faces possible removal from office within weeks. A court is scheduled to rule whether she illegally transferred a high-ranking civil servant. She also faces other legal challenges. Meanwhile, some of her core supporters in the rural north are angry that her cash-strapped government has failed to make payments to about 1 million rice farmers. During recent anti-government protests, a key leader, Sutep Thaksuban, has opposed fresh elections, saying the system is rigged to keep Thaksin and his family in power. Sutep has repeatedly called for the country to be run for an indefinite period by an unelected people's council he would help appoint. The former Democrat Party leader faces murder charges stemming from political unrest in 2010 that turned deadly. At that time, Sutep was deputy prime minister and in charge of a crackdown against red-shirt protesters. News of the tentative election date was a page 3 story in Thursday's Bangkok Post, an apparent indication of how low expectations are that the delayed polling will take place July 20th. The paper's English-language daily rival, The Nation, did make it a page 1 headline, but an analysis on page 2 warned that if leaders on both sides of the political crisis do not compromise, then violent clashes between their supporters, fueled by hatred, will be inevitable. Thailand's military, seen as more sympathetic to the anti-government protesters, has repeatedly indicated it will refrain from launching a coup. Thailand has seen 18 successful or attempted coups since 1932, more than any other country. The ultimate authority in Thailand is the highly revered king, but 86-year-old Bumibol Adunadet has been in poor health. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to call for an end to what Mr. Ban calls a negative campaign against UN peacekeepers and bring to justice those responsible for attacks on civilians and UN staff. In a telephone call, the UN chief urged President Kiir to halt the vicious fighting and appalling killing of South Sudanese civilians. UN aid chief in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, has called for a month-long truce, warning 7 million people face hunger if the four-month conflict continues. Two UN officials are holding talks with South Sudanese leaders in the conflict. Human rights official Navi Pillay and Adama Ding, the UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, have met with Riek Machar, the former vice president who leads rebel forces. Navi Pillay.
We had a good meeting of about 35 minutes and gave him the concerns of the Secretary General about protection of civilians. And we received assurances from him that he himself is investigating the human rights violations that occurred in Bientu, and that he is also concerned about protection of civilians here. He finds it difficult to be in the situation where he is. But I welcome the fact that he is clearly thinking in terms of a political solution.
The United Nations has accused rebels of hunting down hundreds of people in a hospital, church and mosque in Vientiane April 15th and killing them based on their ethnicity and nationality. Hundreds of women and girls were abducted last month in Nigeria, allegedly by Boko Haram. The government has been trying to grapple with the activists of the Islamist terrorist group. In light of this story, we spoke with Max Abrams of Northeastern University and the Council on Foreign Relations, who has just finished a study of militant kidnappings. We asked, under what conditions are hostage takers more likely to achieve their demands?
Yes, this is a question that I focus on extensively in my research. Generally, I look at which tactics are best from the vantage of the perpetrators. And by perpetrators, I usually mean militant groups. So in the case of hostage taking, militant groups tend to take the hostages in order to achieve what's sometimes called redemptive demands. The nature of their demands is often pertains to the building up of their organization. So they may ask for financial demands. Those are the most common. They may ask for the release of prisoners held by the government. They may ask for safe passage into another location, into another country. In the case of Boko Haram, it's not entirely clear why they took the hostages, but presumably to help their organization in a similar way. And I've just completed a statistical study with my co-author, Matthew Gottfried, over at UCLA, where we look at the determinants of hostage-taking success. That is, the likelihood that the hostage takers will achieve at least one of their demands for the organization. And we actually have good news. What we find is that the better the hostage takers treat the hostages, the more likely the government is to subsequently bargain with the hostage takers. In particular, we look at the effects of harming the hostages versus releasing them unharmed. And what we find is that governments are significantly and substantially less likely to trade with the hostage takers after they've physically harmed one of the hostages. And so the implications of the study are really clear for Boko Haram, and that is that Boko Haram is more likely to achieve its demands if it releases unscathed the 273 women in their custody.
Does the treatment of the hostages also contribute to the government's decision whether or not to invade, to attack, and violently end the hostage situation?
In our study, we didn't test that directly. But in other studies of mine, yes, what I have found is that when militant groups attack non-combatants, and this would clearly be a case of that, because the girls were, you know, going to school. And certainly once they were taken as hostages, you know, they weren't in a position to resist. And what I find is that when civilians are harmed by non-state actors, particularly militant groups, governments tend to go on the offensive. They tend to dig in their political heels, and they tend to try to violently oppose the perpetrators. And so for that reason as well, I would strongly urge Boko Haram to release the hostages. They're much unharmed. Doing so would increase the odds that they would achieve their demands and lower the odds that the government will, you know, violently oppose the perpetrators.
Max Abrams, a professor at Northeastern University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. The World Health Organization says it believes the recent spike in cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, coronavirus, is probably due to a seasonal increase of the disease rather to any changes in the behavior of the virus. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says there is nothing unusual about the recent spike in cases of MERS coronavirus. It says similar upsurges have occurred around the same time in the past 2 years. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartl says the increase in cases is most likely due to the warmer weather in the Arabian Peninsula and to outbreaks of the disease in 2 or 3 hospitals in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He says health officials do not know how the virus is transmitted from person to person, but it is clear, he says, the disease does not spread with the same ease that severe acute respiratory syndrome or SARS did.
We don't think it does transmit very efficiently, and it's certainly not anything like SARS or like diseases like influenza. There's no way we can predict the future. But for us at the moment, certainly this virus, MERS, does not have the ability to infect in the same way that SARS did. So that is a good sign.
Hartl says SARS is highly contagious. The disease broke out in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan in the early 2000s. Over a six-month period at the height of the epidemic, nearly 8,100 cases and 774 deaths were reported. By comparison, Hartl notes, WHO has confirmed 261 cases of MERS coronavirus in 2 years. But the downside is that 93 people have died, which is a much higher fatality rate than that of SARS. The MERS coronavirus is shrouded in mystery. Health officials know that camels are one of the hosts of the virus, but they believe the disease may also stem from other sources. They also do not know why some humans get infected and others do not. The virus made its first appearance in Egypt last week. Cases also have been confirmed in Greece, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia. But WHO spokesman Hartl says patients in those countries acquired the disease while they were in Saudi Arabia. He says the virus remains largely contained in the Middle East. He says the virus has not changed its character. 30 viruses have been tested, he says, and none have mutated.
These viruses don't transmit from human to human, because when they transmit from human to human, small changes in the genome of the virus will occur. However, in this case, we believe that this means that almost all the introductions still are coming from the environment somehow.
Hartl says health officials are faced with the big challenge of trying to figure out how the virus passes from its natural host or reservoir to humans. The World Health Organization says in the absence of any drugs to treat the disease, the best way people can protect themselves from falling ill is to practice good general hygiene. WHO says people should wash their hands frequently and keep their distance from people who show signs of MERS. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
British actor Bob Hoskins, whose varied career ranged from an award-winning role in the film Mona Lisa to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, has died. He was 71 years old. Roger Rabbit was filmed in 1988 with both animated and real-life characters, such as the part Hoskins played. He said it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do that kind of acting.
Because it's cinema history. It's never been done before. Not like this.
21 years after filming Roger Rabbit, Hoskins played a character in the animated film A Christmas Carol.
It's incredibly releasing. Once you get used to the fact that there's no camera, there's nothing to perform to except yourself and your fellow artists. And it's just wonderful. You just do it once. There's no angles. There's no camera. It's great.
A versatile character actor capable of menace, poignancy, and cockney charm. Huskins appeared in some of the most acclaimed British films of the past few decades, including gangster classic The Long Good Friday. In 2012, Huskins announced he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and was retiring from acting. He died of complications from pneumonia. Al Feldstein, whose 28 years at the helm of Mad Magazine transformed the satirical publication into a pop culture institution. He has died. He was 88 years old. Building on a character used by Mad founding editor Harvey Kurtzman, Feldstein turned the freckle-faced Alfred E. Newman, whose image always appeared on the magazine's cover, into an underground hero, a dim-witted everyman with a gap-toothed smile and the recurring stock phrase, "What, me worry?" Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. May 1st is often called May Day. Traditionally, May Day was celebrated by ancient Europeans as the time to make their first spring plantings. May Day later became an observance sparked by the labor movement to recognize the achievements of the working class. On this day in 1898, only days after war had been declared between Spain and the United States, U.S. Commodore George Dewey achieved a naval victory over the Spanish in the waters of Manila Bay in the Philippines. On this day in 1960, an American U-2 spy plane piloted by Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union. Powers was captured, tried, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. In 1962, he was exchanged for a captured Soviet spy. In 2011, U.S. President Barack Obama announced that terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks on the U.S., had been killed by United States Special Forces in Pakistan. On this day in 1786, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's masterpiece, The Marriage of Figaro, premiered at Court Theater in Vienna. The Marriage of Figaro is today one of the most performed operas in the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Doku Umarov is a fugitive and senior leader and military commander of the Caucasus Emirate, a terrorist group based in the North Caucasus region of Central Asia, seeking to use violence to establish a so-called Islamic Emirate in the North Caucasus, Southern Russia, and Volga regions of the Russian Federation. A Russian citizen born in Chechnya, he's 47 years old, has brown hair and brown eyes, with a full beard and mustache, both brown in color. Under his leadership, the group has conducted suicide bombings and other terrorist acts. He has claimed responsibility for the bombing this January of Moscow's Domodedovo Airport that killed 36 people, the March 2010 suicide bombing of two Moscow subway stations that killed 40 people, and the November 2009 bombing of the high-speed Nevsky Express train in which 28 people died. Umarov has declared the United States, United Kingdom, and other nations to be enemies of the Caucasus Emirate and issued repeated public threats against them. Because of these threats and the violent attacks he has directed against innocent people, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to Umarov's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.